This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Southern Gothic is a podcast that explores the history behind some of the American South's darkest days, greatest mysteries, and most chilling ghost stories. Chapel Hill, Tennessee, is a small town located down in Marshall County. It's about an hour south of Nashville, tucked away in the rolling hills and beautiful farmlands of Middle Tennessee. Known for its close-knit community and charming rural atmosphere, Chapel Hill was settled back in the early 1800s by folks who had received land grants for their service in the Revolutionary War. One of those early settlers, a man named John Laws, named the community after his hometown of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. But the town didn't receive an official charter until 1889. Today, however, the quaint town has become more of a suburb for the Middle Tennessee area than anything, with most of its residential growth stemming from the nearby car manufacturing facilities that have been springing up over the last couple decades, rather than its agricultural roots. But some people do still visit Chapel Hill for one of two reasons. First, its proximity to the beautiful Henry Horton State Park, where people can explore the diverse ecosystem and surrounding wilderness of the historic Duck River. And second, to check out one of the most notorious legends in the state, a ghost story that has earned this otherwise charming town a spot on Southern Living Magazine's 12 Most Haunted Places in the South. According to local lore, for almost a century, folks who dare head out to the old L&L train tracks at night on the edge of town have found themselves face to face with a strange ball of light that eerily bounces down the line without any known explanation or cause. It is a spectacle that's become known simply as the Chapel Hill Ghost Light. My name is Brandon Schecksnyder, and you are listening to Southern Gothic. It was a cold winter night, sometime around the 1920s or 30s, when two trains were scheduled to pass each other near the small town of Chapel Hill, Tennessee. The process was pretty simple and standard, and one done by train operators every night on their routes all over the country. The conductor of the first train would stop at the destination, hop out of the locomotive, and pull a switch that would allow his engineer to move them over onto the siding tracks, which were a short stretch of rail line where they'd then sit and wait for the others to pass. Then, once the train had gone by, the conductor would pull the next switch and signal his engineer to steam ahead, back onto the main set of tracks to continue their scheduled trip. Well, on this particular night, everything seemed to be going as planned, and the southernbound train was in sight less than 5 minutes after the first had switched tracks, eventually roaring by the siding track at full speed, seemingly without any issue. But when the engineer looked for the lantern signal from the conductor, which would indicate they could proceed onward, he saw nothing. At first, he didn't think anything of it and just waited patiently, until after about 15 minutes or so, he started to get a little antsy. After all, railroad men took great pride in maintaining their schedules. So he hopped out of the engine and began walking down the tracks in search of his conductor. To the engineer's dismay, he saw nothing. Anxiously, he began shouting the conductor's name, hoping for a response, but the only sound he heard was his own voice echoing back at him from the darkness. It was then, after walking the entire length of the train, that he noticed a mist rising above the main track. Thinking it just might be his conductor smoking a cigarette, he meandered over, a little annoyed at his colleague, but as he approached, he didn't see what he expected. Instead, he saw the conductor's lantern on the ground, shattered, with a faint glow still emanating. So he cautiously approached, and when he bent down to pick up the lantern, he saw the horrifying truth of where that mist was coming from. The conductor's severed head was staring up at him, and the tracks were covered with blood. It seemed as if when that train roared past them on the main track, the conductor must have slipped or fallen without anyone knowing any different, and the heavy steel wheels of that train barreling forward just took his head clean off. The man's body lay only several feet away, down the embankment, and it too was still steaming in the cold night air. In shock, the engineer took off for help, screaming to the train's brakeman for assistance, crying out for someone, anyone to do anything. But when the men returned to retrieve their fallen colleague's headless body, it was not there. It is said that from this day on, strange things happen out on that stretch of track near Chapel Hill. Seemingly supernatural events that have been witnessed by hundreds of people who have dared return to the spot of this tragedy. Tennessee-based author Pat Fitzhugh chronicled some of these experiences in his 2009 book, Ghostly Cries from Dixie.
Although the area seems peaceful, a headless figure carrying a lantern down the track late at night has frightened people for years. The ghastly figure wanders up and down a half-mile stretch of track, sometimes for an hour or longer, before fading away. The figure is oblivious to onlookers unless they throw rocks at him or try to photograph him, in which case he suddenly vanishes.
But as terrifying as confronting an apparition of this nature in the middle of the night might be, most of the people who've claimed to have come face to face with the supernatural on that old rail track say it, quote, manifests in the form of a tiny flickering light at the edge of the nearby woods. This phenomenon is now famously known as the Chapel Hill Ghost Light, and it's a piece of local lore that has evolved into one of the most notorious Tennessee ghost stories, eclipsed only by the likes of the Bell Witch. And over the years, folks have come from all over to witness that ghost light, which, as I said, has been purportedly seen by hundreds of people. Famed folklorist Catherine Tucker Windham not only chronicled several of the most infamous encounters that folks have had with the mysterious light in her 1977 work, 13 Tennessee Ghosts and Jeffrey, but she also described what a typical encounter with the ghost light looks like. A description that, honestly, isn't much different today, almost 50 years later.
These witnesses tell basically the same story. They tell of going, usually late at night, to a railroad crossing near Chapel Hill. They stand facing north between the rails, they say, and the light comes swooping down the tracks toward them. It appears from nowhere, they say, a giant glowing ball that quickly vanishes into the darkness. Some witnesses say the ball of light dances and cavorts around, almost as though as it were playing a game of tag. Others report that the light moves unerringly forward in a straight line until it disappears from sight. And when it disappears, the Chapel Hill light leaves behind it an aura of uneasiness, of foreboding, of fear.
One of the stories Windham includes in her book is the experience of a young man named Jackie Gentry. Gentry, his uncle, and a friend all went out one night hoping to see the lights for themselves, but they ended up getting more than they bargained for. Like most who make this trek, the three men shuffled around in the darkness for quite a bit of time, throwing rocks into the woods and knocking around on the railroad tracks, trying to sustain themselves through the sheer boredom of waiting for something to happen. Well, after getting tired of waiting and pretty much giving up hope they'd see anything at all, the light finally emerged from the darkness on the tracks before them.
As they watched, the circle of light advanced and retreated, bobbing about as though following the pattern of a traditional dance. Then it paused and swooped toward Jackie.
A loud sound ensued and a, quote, sudden chill went through the young man's body. And Jackie Gentry stood there completely paralyzed by the eerie sensation. He was frozen on the tracks. Gentry's uncle and friend watched in disbelief as it happened, and then as quickly as it came, the light left his person and darted right back from where it came, fading away into the night. Now, whether Jackie Gentry is real or not is up for debate, although we did find a Jack Gentry from Marshall County in both census records and World War II draft cards about the time this would have happened, but it's also possible that he's just a character Windham created to describe what a typical encounter with the ghost light is like. After all, back in the 60s, it was such a popular destination for thrill seekers and legend trippers that Marshall County Sheriff Mallard Tillman told a reporter from the Nashville Banner that he was going to have to do something about it.
If all these sightseers and ghost hunters don't keep away from down there, I'm going to start making arrests. They park their cars in there, and the people who live in the area can't get in or out. Just the other night, we had to chase about 40 or 60 automobiles out of there.
That's right, y'all. The lore of the ghost light had grown so popular at that point in the early 60s that ghost hunters were starting to cause problems for the locals, and this was almost two decades before Catherine Tucker Windham's book brought the legend to a national audience. In fact, I personally know someone here in Tennessee who told me they themselves ended up in the back of a cop car in the 70s when she, her husband, and another couple drove out to Chapel Hill one night from nearby Spring Hill just to see if they could see the notorious ghost light for themselves. But like many, all they got were police lights. Windham's book was not the spirit's only exposure to a national audience, though. Around the same time it was published in 1977, a local band named Us Two and Him released an album called The Chapel Hill Pickers, which included a song with the title of, you guessed it, Chapel Hill Ghostlight. The band has been described as a country comedy trio with a, quote, slightly more hick-oriented version of the classic Kingston Trio-style folk tunes and stand-up shtick. Songwriter, band member, and Chapel Hill native John Rickman wrote the tune, but in his version, he doesn't reference the tale as I told it before. Instead, he writes that the ghost light is the spirit of Skip Agent, a young man who was hit and killed by a train. Now, y'all, I'd love to play this song for you now, but, you know, there's this whole licensing thing. So instead, I'm going to read you the lyrics, but please check the show notes for a link to hear the original. Many years ago, along the railroad track one night, a man was walking home and held a lantern for his light. He never heard the whistle scream or the mighty engine pound. He never even knew it when the freight train ran him down. The engineer ran back in time to see the poor man die, but as he neared the tragic spot, a light rose in the sky. The lamp the man carried was never found that night. Now the old folks say above the track, his lantern shining bright. Just a few years ago, Rickman was interviewed on Nashville's local news station, and he acknowledged that over the years, there have been a lot of different versions of the legend of the ghost light, but that the one he sang about was the only one that was actually true. Unfortunately, I personally cannot verify this claim. And that's in spite of the fact that some websites go so far as to say that Skip died on June 8, 1942. But even with that, I still cannot find any indication that he either lived or died in Chapel Hill. Not on census records, in newspapers, or even the indexes of local cemeteries. I even did a statewide search. Does that mean Rickman is wrong? Not necessarily. Just means I can't find Agent in any of the documents I have access to, and we do know that several people were killed on those tracks. However, there is one other story that folks have claimed might be the cause of the infamous ghost light, and not only does this event have quite the paper trail to back it up, but you might even remember us discussing it before in another episode that we did, titled The Seer of Shelbyville. It involves the murder of a local woman named Lillian Ketchum. Y'all, if you are anywhere near Little Rock, Arkansas on Saturday, April 20th, there's a wonderful event that I'd like to invite you to down at the Old State House Museum. Y'all remember that place from the episode we did last Halloween, right? Well, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., come join the Old State House Museum, the Arkansas State Archives, and Historic Arkansas Museum as they present Anarchy in Arkansas, an interpretation and commemoration of the Brooks-Baxter War, which was a month-long armed conflict between the respective supporters of Joseph Brooks and Elijah Baxter for Arkansas's governorship, an event that marked the end of the Civil War era in the natural state. Historians are going to be out there telling the story of Arkansas's very own Civil War and presenting on various aspects of the affair, making it a must-attend event for folks like you who are interested in digging deeper into the history that helped shape the region we live in today. To learn more about this exciting event that will be taking place at the Old State House Museum on April 20th, be sure to visit ArkansasHeritage.com today. That's ArkansasHeritage.com.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
In January of 1941, Mrs. Lillian Ketchum, the mother of two young children, disappeared from a rural home in Chapel Hill, Tennessee. Days passed while the town searched for her, but the only thing that they found was a piece of her Sunday coat and a note that she'd left for her sons Grady and David the night she went missing. It said she'd be home for dinner, but Mrs. Ketchum never returned. From the start, though, it was pretty clear what had happened, as right after she went missing, Robert Skinner, a local man whom she'd been dating for a few years, committed suicide. Sheriff Ogilvie told the Tennessean,
"She and Skinner had been going together for about 2 years. I understand that Mrs. Ketchum on Tuesday told Skinner that they could never marry as she had a husband in a state hospital and that they could not be divorced. Skinner shot himself Tuesday night, and several persons reported me that he said he'd be better off dead as they would get me when they found Miss Lillian."
But even with this information and understanding of the likelihood of Mrs. Ketchum's fate, Skinner's suicide stonewalled law enforcement and their search for her whereabouts. And so eventually, due to the lack of progress and fruitless searching, a couple of folks took it upon themselves to head to the nearby town of Shelbyville and seek assistance in finding the missing mother of two from a man named Simon Warner, a sort of fortune teller who was known by folks from all over as the Seer of Shelbyville. Well, Warner greeted these distressed folks into his home and studied the information and evidence that they had brought him. He then gazed into a crystal ball through his black, thick-rimmed glasses and found an answer. Exactly what he told them is unknown, but whatever it was, it led to the exact spot where Mrs. Ketchum's body had been all of this time, underneath a pile of brush about 150 yards from Robert Skinner's house on his farm in the Flat Creek section of Williamson County. Horrifically, her neck was broken and there were signs of strangulation, confirming what most in the town had feared. Of course, since Simon Warner was involved and the case was seemingly solved by a clairvoyant, the story was broadcast on the front page of newspapers all across the state, with one headline even boldly claiming, "Murder and suicide said solved with tips from fortune teller." As you can imagine, this was a pretty big event to happen in such a small town that really only had a population of about 400 at this time. So some folks have claimed that this is the true cause of the Chapel Hill ghost light. Tennessee-based author Lyle Russell recently covered the ghost light on his podcast, Tennessee Ghosts and Legends, and he offered his own take on this variation of the tale.
It is said the occurrences of the light did not start until after Mrs. Ketchum was found, and that the light was her spirit erratically wandering the woods near where she died, searching for her sons. When a young man is nearby, her light races towards them to see if it is one of her boys, and disappears just as quickly when the spirit of her neighbor and abductor who committed suicide comes for her.
Now y'all, I'll be honest, while there are certainly folks down in Chapel Hill who believe it to be the case, I personally don't think that either the murder of Lillian Ketchum or the purported 1942 death of Skip are the actual origin of this piece of local lore. And no, that ain't because I think the original story I told you about the headless conductor is full of fact. I mean, there's less to corroborate that legend than any of them. Rather, I just think the legend is older than that because of how local folks talked about hearing it growing up. One example of this is from 1962, when the Nashville Banner was interviewing folks about the ghost light, which at the time they referred to as the Ghost of Happy Hill, due to the area of Chapel Hill where it was always seen. Well, local Willie Robertson said he not only knew about the ghost light growing up there, but he even had a scare searching for it back in the 30s.
"I was born and reared over in Happy Hill with that story ringing in my ears. In fact, there was one night when I was sure I had found the ghost. It was 24 years ago, and I was returning home from a Boy Scout meeting. I remember the night in vivid detail. There wasn't a star in the sky, nothing but darkness all around. I kept thinking about those ghost stories, and I guess I was whistling to keep up my spirits. Anyway, just as I got close to the tracks, I saw a yellowish light up ahead. Believe me, I was scared silly.
As far as I can tell, Robertson was about 40 years old when this interview was published, and his scare on the tracks likely took place around 1937. However, he makes it clear that he had heard about the ghost light well before that.
I still remember how my flesh used to crawl when the old folks would glance toward the tracks and tell how it soon would be walking again.
So when did the Chapel Hill ghost light make its first appearance on that lonely stretch of train tracks? And even more importantly, why does it continue to appear there today after almost a century has passed? Of course, in some of our older episodes, we have covered a number of similar phenomena, from the Brown Mountain Lights of North Carolina to Le Foufoulet of Cajun swamplands, which resemble the classic Will-o'-the-Wisp type folklore. But there's also the Gurdon Light out in Arkansas and the Mako Light of Brunswick County, North Carolina, which both carry a legend eerily similar to the Chapel Hill ghost light. You see, all three have local lore claiming that the mysterious light bouncing down the tracks in their respective places is the glow of an ethereal lantern carried by the spirit of a decapitated rail worker. Now, y'all, I'm obviously not going to say that these similarities dispute the presence of the actual phenomena. Rather, I think that the parallel between the tales just helped date the legend to a time closer to the turn of the century when railroad lore was at its most prevalent due to not only the popularity of this type of transportation, but also the time when the number of accidents started to peak due to the sheer number of trains and general disregard for safety. That being said, skeptics hone in on these details and claim the Chapel Hill lights are nothing more than either swamp gas, reflections from cars, or some other naturally occurring event, just like they've said about all of those others. But here's the thing. No one has ever proven it one way or the other. In the end, I think the Nashville Banner likely published the closest thing that we will ever get to the truth about the Chapel Hill ghost light when they interviewed a man who was there when all those purported stories happened.
Access to the area is along a narrow, twisting one-lane road, a portion of which is covered with overlapping tree limbs. It dead ends at the farm home of Elgin Luge, a man who helped lay the railroad track in 1913 to 14.
I've been living around here all my life and have been right here for the past 11 years, but I ain't never seen that light be talked about. Why, I bet I've passed that crossing at every minute of the night and day during my lifetime, and it ain't never flashed on for me.
Luge has heard the stories, though, and he traces their origins back to a day 40 or 42 years ago, when he helped gather up the body of Henry Meese.
It was scattered over a half-mile section of track. There were some folks who thought maybe Mr. Meese had been killed and then put on the tracks. Anyway, it wasn't long afterwards that people started claiming they saw strange things happening down the tracks. Since that tragedy, two others have been killed near the same location.
Well, y'all, according to cemetery records, there was a man named Henry Meese who did in fact die in Marshall County, Tennessee in 1919. He is now buried at the Farmington Cemetery. To this day, folks still drive out to Chapel Hill, Tennessee, in an attempt to experience the ghost lights firsthand. And like many of the stories we've told you, there are ghost hunters who make claims to have captured evidence of this light. However, whether or not this is or isn't true, if you do decide to go see for yourself, be safe, because that strip of track might seem like it's in the middle of nowhere, but it certainly ain't inactive and is still as dangerous as ever. My name is Brandon Schecksnyder, and you are listening to Southern Gothic. Southern Gothic is an independent podcast produced by Southern Gothic Media. This week's episode was written by myself, Brandon Schecksnyder, with a special thanks to Lyle Russell of the Tennessee Ghosts and Legends podcast for allowing us to include a segment of his show. Y'all be sure to go check out other episodes he's released as well. Of course, if you're looking for ways to listen to Southern Gothic ad-free, be sure to head over to southerngothicmedia.com/listen or check the show notes. And y'all, as always, thanks for listening.
Lucky Lady Shacks.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.